This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. The fate of medical marijuana in Florida will go to the voters. This week, the Florida State Supreme Court, on a 4-3 vote, approved language for a proposed constitutional amendment to appear on the November ballot. John Morgan spent $4 million to fund the petition drive that collected the signatures for the measure to qualify for the ballot. Morgan said his quadriplegic brother was his motivation.
His pain is unbelievable. At one point, they had him on 7 Xanax to control his spasms and pain. But marijuana alleviates the pain, takes care of the spasms. And so in the back of my mind, as I've gone through this whole deal, I keep thinking of my brother Tim.
Morgan is a personal injury attorney in Orlando. One of the lawyers who works at his firm, Charlie Crist, the former Republican governor, now Democratic gubernatorial candidate. When asked about this issue last week, Governor Rick Scott reiterated his personal opposition.
Are you going to get out front and lead against it?
You know, I've said it along. I'm against illegal drug use. I've watched how it impacts families. The Attorney General gave her best advice to the Supreme Court.
But the Supreme Court will allow the voters to decide certain uses of medical marijuana in November. Should Florida doctors be allowed to prescribe marijuana? Does the amendment appropriately limit doctors' ability to prescribe it? How could this impact voter turnout in the hotly contested governor's race? All ahead here on the Florida Roundup. Glenn Garvin from the Miami Herald along with us, and Margie Menzel with the News Service of Florida. Join us as well, won't you, at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, on Twitter at WLRN, and our web chat online at WLRN.org. Margie, what would this amendment do if voters approve it in November?
Well, it seems pretty clear that the people who authored it are trying to present it as appropriately constrained. We've heard from opponents, it's going to be like California. You're going to be able to buy it on every corner. That's not what the court appears to have found, although, as you know, there's a lot of controversy about it. But according to a rundown that the Tampa Bay Times did, questions and answers about medical marijuana in Florida, it wouldn't make it available to people who'd had just any condition. It wouldn't make it legal to be using it at work or at school.
Right.
You wouldn't be able to use it on the street, you know, all of that kind of thing. It would be appropriately constrained.
The key phrase here, Glenn, in the amendment is, quote, allows the medical use of marijuana for individuals with debilitating disease as determined by licensed Florida physician.
I'm a little skeptical that all of these constraints will really be applied if the thing passes. We've seen this in California, in Colorado, which had a limited medical marijuana before it passed the
recreational use.
And I should say a theoretically limited medical marijuana, because in both those states, it really did run wild. I don't think we can say with any certainty that would happen in Florida, but once marijuana gets the foot in the door, it does tend to spread. There's a lot of people who like to use it recreationally.
Well, Margie, I mean, in the dissenting opinions, this was a very close vote of the high court. I mean, it was 4-3, and among the dissenting opinions really got into, obviously, the language, talking about how it was confusing, potentially confusing for voters. One dissenting opinion talking about the confusion over the phrase debilitating diseases and the phrase certain medical conditions, some of those limitations, Glenn, that you refer to, as the ballot title refers to as well. And Margie, one of the dissenting opinions from the high justices talked about great concern that the voter would not be fairly and clearly apprised of the proposal's chief purpose. What is that referring to?
Well, the chief purpose is conditions like cancer, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, hepatitis C, ALS, multiple sclerosis.
And those are all debilitating diseases spelled out in the ballot language, correct?
Correct. So, you know, there is a fear that doctors would push the limit of, you know, what's a debilitating disease. Oh, you're nervous about getting on a flight tomorrow? Let me prescribe you some marijuana. I'm not sure how realistic that is, but Attorney General Pam Bondi said Wednesday at the Associated Press Legislative Planning Day, I pray that the doctors are more ethical than the ones who are prescribing painkillers.
Well, exactly. That's what I was just going to say. You know, the guidelines are much more clear on prescription painkillers, and yet you've got these pill mills where they're prescribed like candy. Whether this is a good thing or not, I don't know, but I think it's naive to think that there won't be abuse.
Well, when we're talking about prescription drugs, those are regulated not only at the state level, but also at the federal level. There's the Food and Drug Administration, which is an agency of the federal government. And again, back to the dissenting opinions by putting this to the Florida voters from the Florida State Supreme Court, one of the justices worrying that the ballot measure pledges, quote, will not authorize violations of federal law. But the dissenting justice worried, Glenn, the truth is that violation of federal law unquestionably are authorized by the amendment.
I think that's absolutely correct. I don't see how anybody can deny that. Federal law clearly prohibits the use of marijuana.
That's right.
And the Obama administration...
Period. It prohibits it, period.
And the Obama administration at first said it was going to prosecute this stuff. It's backed off now. But I think there's no question that this will be in violation of federal law.
And Margie, you know, the examples that are going to be cited over the next several months moving toward November, lots of folks are going to point to Colorado with the recreational use. Lots of folks are going to point to the Washington State use as well as violating federal law. But where are the federal authorities in those states that that seem to be turning the other way?
It's definitely a thing that spreads, and I guess I'm sitting here wondering, has the horse already left? Is it too late to shut? I mean, 82% of the voters say that they favor legalizing medical marijuana. So, I mean, that kind of we'll suggests that there's a
public support
demand
for it.
Here.
Yeah, and we'll see if those voters show up in November. Robert is joining us here on the Florida Roundup talking about the ballot amendment that will go forth in November that could allow limited use of marijuana for medical purposes in Florida. Robert from Hollywood, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking the call.
Go ahead.
As a Florida abatement contractor and a special abatement contractor, I had a fairly bad accident back in 1988, fell a significant distance of 48 feet, and I just happened to come into the time as I was coming out of recovery where OxyContin was being made readily available to patients with injuries. Well, sure enough, I became addicted to the medication. It was readily dispensed. I could have acquired all that I wanted. As the pill mill started to get cracked down, obtaining OxyContin was getting more and more difficult, so I decided to downgrade to a lesser form of medication. And unfortunately, due to the severity of injuries, they prescribed me morphine, which is also an opiate, to reduce my amount of intake. Well, I used medical cannabis to reduce the intake and to reduce the symptoms that I was encountering.
Robert, do you use medicinal marijuana legally?
No, sir, I do not. Unfortunately, I'm on the other side of the fence right now.
So you use marijuana. Why do you call it medical marijuana at this point? Is a doctor prescribing it to you illegally?
No, that is not true. Unfortunately, I'm assessing it on the streets. There is no doctor that can prescribe it to me. I am a former resident of Southern California, and I went over there to pursue my options. And due to the debilitating injury that I have, they would readily prescribe it.
Robert joining us from Hollywood, and Margie and Glenn, we imagine we're going to hear a lot of those voices like Robert as we move toward this November ballot. Glenn, how do you think that this could impact even voter turnout?
Well, that's really a good question, I think. As Margie noted, 82% of Floridians support legalizing medical marijuana, and interestingly, that's 70% includes 70% of Republicans. So the support is pretty broad and pretty bipartisan. But you never know who's going to turn out. My sense is that the people who oppose this are a lot more adamant in their opposition than most of the people who support it.
And those who support it.
Right. So we'll see.
Margie, one thing that's interesting that we haven't heard yet here in the state of Florida, and I'm wondering if you think we will, is an economic argument for the limited legalization of cannabis. In other words, the taxing potential.
The taxes.
Exactly. Right.
From Colorado is that, you know, this is a money-making enterprise.
Right.
So, but Florida is a much different kind of state. What I wanted to say before we get too far away from it is because this is not a presidential year, normally you wouldn't see younger people at the polls, but with this ballot initiative, it's much more likely. And, you know, it's pretty clear to political observers that that's one of the reasons for it.
One of the reasons for this ballot measure is to get out the younger vote, presumably to then...
More socially liberal.
More yes. socially liberal. And, you know, the question becomes, if they're going to vote on this one particular ballot measure, will they actually take the time to fill out the entire ballot?
Well, that's an important question.
Yeah.
I can't let this go by without noting the irony of this. I was a college student in 72, when California had the first big public initiative on marijuana. And it came close but failed, and everybody said, by 76, we're going to win this.
Yep.
Because more and more young people are hitting voting age, and we're going to switch the whole thing. Well, that didn't happen. California to this day has not legalized marijuana. And it turned out that baby boomers, as they got older and had parents of their own, got a lot more conservative on the question of drugs. And now we're saying that it'll have to be the younger people, not their baby boomer parents, yeah. who will carry this thing through.
Yeah.
It amuses me.
And Glenn, it bears noting, the governor of California during that 1972 cannabis campaign
was Ronald Reagan.
Ronald That's Reagan, right. Republican, right. absolutely. Which brings us back to the gubernatorial race in 2014. Modern day times here in the Sunshine State. A lot going on in that regard. Governor Scott releasing his budget, his spending blueprint for this campaign year. We'll talk about that and find out what it says about his spending priorities. Still to come as the Florida Roundup on WLRN continues. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. $74.2 billion. That's how much Governor Scott wants to spend in the next year running state government here in the Sunshine State. It calls for $500 million in tax and fee reductions, more than $500 million in education funding, and more state money for child protection and to market Florida to the rest of the world, a.k.a. tourism. Is this money well spent? Well, join us here at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, on the web at WLRN.org, and on Twitter, use the handle at WLRN. Glenn Garvin from the Miami Herald and Margie Menzel from the News Service of Florida along with us here as we crack open the spending blueprint here, Margie. Lots to cover, but what do you think this spending plan says about the governor's priorities this campaign year?
I think it says that he would like to be reelected.
Explain that further.
Well, I think if there's any mulligan that Rick Scott could take on what he's done as governor, it would be that $1.3 billion cut to education his first year.
Yeah.
Because it set him off with parents and teachers and a lot of people concerned about the economy and understanding the connection between education and Florida's economy, which he seems to have come around to since then. But that impression has been really hard for him to shake. And the proof of the pudding is the day after he rolls out this budget with what he called a historic increase in education spending. There's dispute about that. But the next day, Quinnipiac comes out and says a majority of Floridians trust Crist yeah. over Scott with the economy and jobs.
Yeah, and I think that was really telling, Glenn, is, you know, Governor Scott elected at a time, of course, when the national economy was really suffering, the global economy was really suffering, and Governor Scott's going to run on his record that he's going to point to of job creation in the state and company creation in the state and whatnot. But what does this budget tell us about how his priorities have changed as he's moved through his administration?
Oh, I don't know if they've changed at all. When Margie said his priority is to get reelected.
Well,
that is
certainly.
Exactly the same thing I would have said. And I think what you really find out when Republicans govern is that they're this idea that they're cost cutters and penny savers is really not true. In the end, like most politicians, they attract votes by delivering pork. Now, they may move around the recipients of that pork.
Where do you see the bacon in the Scott proposal then?
Well, the education is the obvious thing where he's completely reverse course. How can he do that, and if he really believes the things he said in the first place. I think there's just an inexplicable, well, it's explicable, but there's and I can't think of the word I'm looking for, an uncorrectable chasm there between word and deed.
All right, well, let's see if we can forge a bridge of that chasm. Our State Impact Education reporter, Sammy Mack, here is along with us. Sammy, yes, this is a political document. Certainly, there's no doubt about it. Every proposed budget is, regardless if it's a campaign year or not. But forge that chasm that that Margie and that Glenn are talking about between Governor Scott year one cutting state education funding, and now here we are in his reelection campaign year, increasing it, what he calls an historic increase in K-12 education funding.
Yeah, that year that he cut about $1.3 billion, don't forget, he had asked to cut a little more than $3 billion.
That's right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so this is a very different kind of budget. It is true, folks screamed when that happened. Educators, students, parents, teachers, districts, pretty much everybody downhill of those cuts.
Sure. We're
very, very upset with it.
As would happen in any agency or industry that's going to see a budget cut.
Yeah, and he took a lot of criticism, and he took a lot of criticism a couple years in a row. Even last year, he restored a lot of money to that budget. And even then, you know, it was every time there was an article written about the money that went back into the budget, the line immediately after it was, he had removed $1.3 billion the year before.
Yeah.
So he's having if this is in his interest as sort of an investment in getting reelected, he is definitely going to be carrying that $1.3 billion loss with him.
In the meantime, this budget, this K-12 proposed budget, increases state spending on Florida kindergarten through 12th graders by $169 to $6,949 per student as we move into the next school year. Two words, Sammy: Common Core. How to square the governor's spending plan with the continued resistance, sometimes not so quiet, on the part of the governor's supporters in regards to the Common Core standards?
I'm not sure that I can do that. you know, Common Core is here. It's very, very clear from what has happened in the past couple months that Florida is sticking to those new standards. They tweaked them a little bit, yeah, but basically it is Common Core. They call them Florida standards. It's Common Core.
Margie, how about it? Can you square the Common Core criticism that the governor faces in his own party to this to the spending plan that he released this week on education?
It is really a little hard for me to understand the objections to Common Core in Florida, where Jeb Bush has been so vocal in his advocacy for it and where he still carries so much sway. And all that we've seen is that the changes they're making to Common Core are really pretty cosmetic.
Cursive, you know, writing, calculus, those kinds,
right,
of things.
The loudest, you know, criticism to Common Core has come from people who are Tea Party aligned. A lot of them don't like being identified as Tea Party, but Tea Party aligned, who have said that, you know, that this is really the federal government, that this is going to be putting electrodes on kids' heads, and that has been like a very loud group of opponents to, mm-hmm, Common Core, with criticism that I haven't been able to report out and find that there is any evidence for. That said, what has happened because of that is there is another group of folks who are opposed to Common Core or who take issue with it that have a more subtle critique of it, which is that the teachers who support the standards in general feel like they haven't had the training that they need to deliver with the students, and that they haven't had the time that they need to integrate it into the way that they teach in a way that meets what the standards are.
Sammy Mack with State Impact Education reporter here on WLRN, Glenn Garvin for the Miami Herald, and Margie Menzel with the News Service of Florida. All along for our ride here on the Florida Roundup, I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for joining us. Give us a call at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, on Twitter at WLRN, and our web chat ongoing right now. You can join us online at WLRN.org. We're talking some politics and spending in politics regarding Governor Scott's proposed budget on education. Let's talk here, Sammy, because there's the technology part of education. There's the technology part of Common Core that is a big, significant potential of costs in the years ahead.
Yeah, you and I have been talking a lot about Common Core, but the other giant thing that is going to be coming to Florida schools that has sort of been overshadowed by the urgency of Common Core is this technology mandate. Starting in 2015, half of all instruction in classrooms in Florida will need to be digital. And we don't have a clear sense of what that is necessarily going to look like and how much it's going to cost. And in this budget, there is $40 million set aside to support that transition. Mm-hmm. And there's also been some legislation introduced by or supported by Will Weatherford and Legg. And that would ask school districts to sort of define how they're thinking about technology, what they're doing with it, how they're tracking whether or not it's working. So you start to hear the sort of assessment talk mm-hmm. around this digital initiative. And it's going to be a very large change in the environment in the classroom. And there's not a great sense yet of what exactly that's going to look like.
A big change in the classroom and a big change in spending as well, because obviously this technology comes with some significant price tags.
It's not a one-time cost.
It's a big investment, absolutely, maintaining it. Digital technology is something that the former governor, Jeb Bush, has been pushing, obviously, for education. And he was in South Florida this week in a very public way, Sammy, talking Common Core, talking technology at a school in Hialeah with the Latin Builders Association Construction and Business Management Academy. Tell us why the former governor decided to become kind of public figure again now and there.
This week is National School Choice Week, and he and his foundation have been big proponents of school choice. And this is going beyond the traditional public school, offering charter schools, school vouchers, magnet school programs. All of that is sort of tied up in what we talk about when we talk about school choice. He's been a big proponent of that. So he was in town at this Hialeah charter school to kind of take a tour and have the media follow him around and ducked in and out of some classrooms. And at one point, he went into a debate classroom and held a mini press conference with all of us journalists there. And the kids got to see what that sort of looks like, which was kind of fun for them and for us too, or at least for me. And this is what he said about Common Core and standardized testing.
If great teachers, as like the ones that exist here, teach to the standards, then you don't have to teach to the test.
Which is interesting because we right now don't know what the next standardized test that's going to replace the FCAT will be.
Right.
And so he had, you know, been a pretty important figure in standardized testing in Florida and pushing towards school grades and all those things. And now that we're sort of at an unstable point, he's focusing on the standards.
Florida at one point was holding the purse strings, was responsible for bringing together the funding from other states to develop this new Common Core standard testing that states would use. Glenn, it was middle of last year or so that Florida said, no, we're not going to be the treasurer for this funding. And we continue to see the state really push itself away. And that is bringing up real concern about the dollars that are going to be involved in this education testing and where those dollars may be directed toward.
That's an excellent point. There's a lot about education funding that is elusive to me. I don't really understand all this talk about digital instruction. What does that mean? Does that mean people will be instead of reading a bound paper book, people will read a Kindle?
It may. Yeah.
It's entirely possible, but that's the thing. Nobody's entirely sure.
Well, do we think that's an educational improvement, that people will read better on a Kindle than in a bound book, or is that a long-term cost saving? If the latter, then maybe it makes some sense. But I'm not one who believes in the magic of gadgetry. I don't think you learn to read any better on a computer type device than you do a regular book. And I think a lot of this has been not very well defined to the people who, of course, are going to foot the bills for it.
Glenn Garvin with the Miami Herald. And one other final point on the governor's budget is regarding health care, Margie. There was a significant cut in what the governor is proposing to spend for the Agency for Health Care Administration. This is a $678 million reduction, Margie. partially due to the state no longer receiving all the federal dollars under the Affordable Care Act available for Medicaid.
Well, that's right, but it doesn't mean that no one's going to get Medicaid in Florida. And in fact, we know that your own state senator down there, Rene Garcia, mm-hmm. has said that he will bring back the question of expanded Medicaid and that $51 billion in federal funding for it. One thing that Senate President Don Gates and House Speaker Will Weatherford agreed on Wednesday at the AP Legislative Planning Day was, number one, their chambers are apart again. If you recall, the Senate favors some kind of flexible plan that looks more like Florida Kid Care in order to get the money. The House, no way. One thing that Speaker Weatherford said on Wednesday was that he still didn't feel the federal government was being flexible enough in working with Florida mm-hmm. about how it could deliver those funds in a way that, you know, our legislature would find acceptable.
Well, they haven't been able to find it acceptable, certainly in the last 12 months. We'll see what the next legislative session holds. Margie Mansell with News Service of Florida, Glenn Garvin from the Miami Herald, Sammy Mack from State Impact WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. You can join the conversation at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, our web chat at WLRN.org, and tweet us using the handle at WLRN. This week, it was also about national politics. The State of the Union address, President Obama putting immigration reform back on the national political agenda.
Finally, if we're serious about economic growth, it is time to heed the call of business leaders, labor leaders, faith leaders, law enforcement, and fix our broken immigration system. Republicans and Democrats in the Senate have acted, and I know that members of both parties in the House want to do the same.
That was it, though, on immigration reform from the president at the State of the Union. Miami-Dade College student Myra Rubio Limon is an undocumented immigrant who grew up here in South Florida in Homestead. She was in the audience for the president's State of the Union in Washington. Her parents brought her to the U.S. from Mexico when she was 3 years old.
I wish you would have talked to them more on immigration, because that's what I was there for.
The GOP response, meantime, to the president's comment by a Floridian, this time in Spanish, by Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Layton. The Spanish language response mostly echoed the Republican response that was given in English by Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers from Washington State, except for some biographical details. But there was another difference.
Also, it is time to honor our history of legal immigration. To do this, we need to fix our broken immigration system with a permanent solution to ensure that our country will always attract the best, brightest, and most workers from all over the world.
Now, the English version adds to this, reform should include securing our borders, something the Spanish language Republican response did not include. That was a phrase not in that Republican response. Margie Mansell from News Service of Florida, how do these two kind of differences in descriptions of approaching immigration from a Republican standpoint here in 2014 impact the electorate?
They are really facing a difficult choice because, on the one hand, they have so much of their base that's just wild about the idea of securing the borders. And yet, there's the question of the Hispanic vote, especially in Florida. That's kind of moving control of the state away from the Republicans, and they're really concerned about it. So, you know, we've already heard from Speaker Weatherford that he's willing to consider a proposal that would open up immigration in the state. We're waiting to see what the Republicans in Congress will do. They're indicating a greater willingness to compromise than mm-hmm. we've seen before. And it's really surprising, quite frankly, after what happened in 2012, how the Hispanic vote went against them, that it's taken them this long to get there.
Yeah, Glenn, how about that moment? I mean, the president, after dealing with the debt ceiling issue and the budget, said many, many months ago, number one priority was job growth, number two was immigration. And then he limits himself to one paragraph at the end of the State of the Union.
Well, there's been some speculation that they're getting the two parties are getting close to making some fixes in Washington, and that the president didn't want to antagonize Republicans by sort of harping on it in an attacking sort of way.
Which is a little bit odd, because earlier in the speech, he essentially told Congress, I'm going to do things without you if you don't come along.
That's right.
And he's done that with immigration.
And the only thing I can think of, if this analysis is correct, is that his congressional leaders told him, hey, cool it. Don't poke the dog. We're just about to make a deal here.
I agree.
Margie, you agree with that? Maybe that
I do,
that in fact the back channels perhaps may be working in Washington on immigration.
I think they're coming around, and I think that political reality is dictating that.
I think it's really interesting that the English version of the Republican response on immigration was slightly different and deleted that, or the English version
included
added
the securing our borders. Right.
I think, frankly, there's a lot of misconceptions about this. In the 1990s, when we militarized the California's border with Mexico, we had the National Guard out there with tanks, literally building big. The military was building big fences. The two leading proponents of that were Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer, two of the most liberal Democrats in the U.S. Senate.
U.S. senators from the Golden State of California.
So it's not that Democrats don't think the border needs to be secure, but somehow that has become a kind of buzzword for Hispanics. I think that smacks of repression. And Ileana Ross wanted to keep it out of the Spanish version of the Republican response.
Well,
so there you go.
And additionally, Glenn, even the concept of borders may be different here in Florida than in California and
That's
Arizona,
right,
and Texas, right? I mean, Margie, to that point.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's a much different immigration viewpoint, I suppose, that comes because of the historical nature and quite frankly, the geographical position of Florida and the Caribbean, and especially Cuba.
Well, that's exactly right. There's so many different Hispanic countries that are involved with Florida and are our trading partners, that are that Governor Scott has been going on trade missions, mm-hmm, to develop more business opportunities with them, encouraging their tourists to visit our state. And of course, an awful lot of them end up settling here.
Glenn, I think this, in South Florida may in fact be a real canary in the coal mine when it comes to immigration reform and its likelihood of being able to pass muster, especially with House Republicans. And I say that because at an event that I attended not too long ago with the Secretary of Labor, who was here, spoke about two things very clearly to the business leaders gathered, said you need to cajoling them to talk to their elected officials about federal Medicaid funding, of which we just spoke about, and the impact that on the state budget. And also, secondly, Margie, very, very quickly came up with immigration reform, trying to make that economic argument that so many have tried to make.
Well, I think there's a big split developing in the Republican Party over this. Ann Coulter, I'm sure everybody knows who she is, wrote a column yesterday or the day before saying the Republicans are courting political suicide with this thing, and that law should not be dictated. She sounded like an Occupy Wall Street person, actually. She said law should not be dictated by these big corporate leaders who are only interested in their own profits. And just because they want slave labor doesn't mean that we should do that. Now, whether you accept her formulation of the argument or not, it's very interesting that people like Coulter are suddenly, going hammer and tongs against people you would think would be Republican allies.
Glenn Garvin with the Miami Herald, Margie Menzel with the News Service of Florida. Sammy Mack is also along with us with State Impact Education Reporter here on WLRN. This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. We've got plenty more to come here on the program. Stay close, fighting Florida's top spot with human trafficking. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
Club Madonna on Miami Beach
closed by the city after allegations a 13-year-old sex trafficking victim was
forced to dance as an exotic new dancer.
Earlier this month, a 13-year-old made headlines, allegedly forced to work as a new dancer at Club Madonna in Miami Beach. This story really highlighted a misconception about human trafficking here in South Florida. You may think it's a problem in developing countries, but the National Human Trafficking Resource Center says Florida ranks third in the number of calls to its human trafficking national hotline. Miami-Dade County State Attorney Catherine Rundle.
So clearly we weren't looking at the issue in the correct way. Our vision, my vision, was that the real issue was about young people from foreign countries, Singapore, the Philippines, coming in.
But as highlighted with that 13-year-old and her story earlier this month, it is also a domestic problem in a big way. Have you witnessed something you suspect is human trafficking? Are you aware of human trafficking? What's law enforcement doing about it? What about the victims? Glenn Garvin with the Miami Herald still with us. Margie Menzel with News Service of Florida. And Wilson Sayre with WLRN Miami Herald News here along with us. Wilson, first of all, this phrase human trafficking, can you help us define it, what it is?
Yeah, it's really kind of a difficult term because it's the movement of people. Human trafficking, you're, you know, stuck in a car or whatever. But so human trafficking can sometimes look like domestic violence or it can look like prostitution. But human trafficking at its essence is these victims don't have a choice in it. They're being forced to do these things and they don't have a choice to leave. And so that's where the kind of movement of people comes into the play here.
It can be everything from forced labor, agriculture labor,
right.
Domestic labor. It could be sex labor.
Right.
Heard earlier.
And most common in South Florida is this sex trafficking. Florida leads the nation in this issue. And then Broward County actually leads Florida. And there's, you know, lots of explanations for that.
What are those? I mean, why Broward County is the number one county for human trafficking in the United States?
Well, we're not exactly sure, but one of the reasoning is that Broward offers a lot of cheap hotels. It also has a close proximity to Miami, where there's large influxes of people, potential patrons of you know, sex trafficking,
right.
Essentially.
Sure. And when you spoke with the Miami-Dade County Attorney, Catherine Rundle, she acknowledged, of course, this misconception that she herself had.
Right.
As she's begun to understand this issue, how has that changed the prosecution that her office has undertaken?
Right. So like I said earlier, human trafficking is at its core this issue of choice. And on the surface, it can look like, you know, just somebody being abused or various other types of issues. So it takes kind of a trained eye to say, hey, who is involved in this? Is there something deeper? Because often, you know, just saying, hey, you've been a victim of domestic violence is already a touchy subject. Mm-hmm. But then when you're probing, is this something that's been happening for a while? How old are you? How old is the perpetrator? When you start asking those questions, you need to be very careful about how you approach it. And so that training is something that her office has been very active in trying to get law enforcement.
And that acknowledgement, that training has led, has gone from very few prosecutions,
right.
Very few investigations.
Zero.
You can't
Zero
get lower than that.
In 2012.
To how many in
107 filed criminal cases last year.
And so in 1 year, it went from zero to over 100.
Right. And so that's on the trafficking side. So this is people who have in their, you know, control young, mostly young individuals.
And mostly female.
Mostly female. But there's also kind of another on the demand side. You have to look at who's buying these, who's soliciting the services of these young people. And that's more challenging. Who are these Johns out there?
Wilson Sayre with WLR and Miami Herald News. Margie Menzel from News Service of Florida. Margie, this is also getting the attention of Tallahassee as state legislators begin to prepare their agenda. And the Attorney General, in fact, made some comments this week.
She absolutely did. George Sheldon, who's opposing her, talked about it as well. We heard about it from Don Gates and Will Weatherford as they outlined their legislative priorities. It's definitely on the radar up here now. And if I could offer another parallel to domestic violence, 25 years ago, I was fortunate to serve as a staff writer on Governor Lawton Childs's Domestic Violence Task Force. Now we're pretty used to the idea that victims of domestic violence frequently do not come forward or even cover up for the abuser. And we have an idea of what those dynamics are or why a doctor has to ask, how did you get that black eye? Or how the neighbors can reach out to somebody who's in trouble. Well, those were things that we had to learn. And one of the things that the Domestic Violence Task Force did was to bring in all these different professionals, doctors, nurses, all public defenders, you name it, people who had no idea what the signs were. Well, now that's happening with human trafficking, mm-hmm. which has been called an invisible crime.
Yeah,
called. And a lot of times these horrific crimes are taking place in front of us, and we don't know because we don't understand what is constraining the victims.
Katarina Rosenblatt is one of those victims who told her story this week at a conference in Broward County, at Broward College, about her experience as a 13-year-old trafficking victim. Her recruiter had initially come across as an older sister, someone that she could trust. But when she was brought to her hotel room in a special dress, she realized she was no longer among friends.
And there was a man, 65 years old, half-dressed, with a beer belly hanging out, and he was ready to partake in his transaction. I was dressed with my little bride outfit, thinking we were going to play a game, and she said, here's your girl, ready for you. Like he ordered up a pizza.
So I talked to Katarina Rosenblatt as well. And like you said, Margie, this is one of the issues with human trafficking is often it starts at a very young age. About 50% of the cases are over the age of 18, but a lot of those start when they're younger. They just haven't come to light until they're over legal age. And so that's one of the challenges is these people don't want to come out against their perpetrators because they are kind of taught that they should love this person, that they need this person to provide shelter, to provide food for them. So it's really, really challenging.
On the law enforcement side, Margie, Governor Scott's budget proposal that we spoke about earlier does include $1.5 million to help victims of human trafficking. Is this new money that is going toward this?
It is new money, and it's really helping to develop a state response, develop a risk assessment tool, develop what they call a continuum of care, because the victims need a whole lot of different services. They for sure need counseling. They need trauma-informed care. They need medical care. We don't know everything that they need, and part of the purpose of this allocation is to study that and develop a response.
Margie Mansell, News Service of Florida. Wilson Sayre with WLRN Miami Herald News. Glenn Garvin is here as well. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening here on the Florida Roundup.
A person who has been trafficked is a victim, not necessarily a criminal, yet we are finding them in our juvenile justice system. And many times judges are putting them in residential programs simply because of the fear that child is vulnerable to being exploited.
That's the Department of Juvenile Justice Secretary Wansley Walters talking about human trafficking, and you can find all of the coverage from WLRN this week on human trafficking on our website at WLRN.org. Finally this week,
sunlight glancing on the water, life and death are all my own.
Folk singer, peace activist, and troubadour, I think we can fairly use that term here for Pete Seeger, dying this week at the age of 94. Beyond his music, Seeger helped bring attention to the need for clean water, especially back in the 1970s, sailing his sloop Clearwater. Alicia Zuckerman with WLRN Miami Herald News is along with us here. And there is a significant South Florida connection to the sloop.
Yeah, there really is. In 1967, when the sloop was first being built, and it came from a postcard that Pete Seeger saw, and it was a 18th century Dutch ship. And so the sloop Clearwater was modeled after that ship. And he, among the people who oversaw the building of that, was Alan Anapu, who was a skipper from Miami. He was a guy in his 20s. And he went up north to help work on the sloop Clearwater. And 2 years later, he became the first captain ever, and remained associated with that boat over the years continues to this day. He lives in Fort Lauderdale now, so he's spent his whole life as a resident of South Florida.
And he telling stories about sailing this sloop in Maine, sailing the sloop down the Hudson River, sailing the sloop into Washington in the early 1970s, really trying to bring attention to the need of clean water.
Right, for the Clear Water Act,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And so I asked him about his time on the boat, which was obviously significant, and how it changed him. And this is what he told me.
It made me ride a bicycle for 10 years. I didn't own a car for 10 years after I got off the Clearwater. I rode all over wherever I was going in Florida, between Fort Lauderdale and Miami, out to the Seminole Reservation, out to the Miccosukee Reservation.
Pretty significant impact on the skipper's life, huh?
Yeah, indeed. He actually told me that after 10 years, the only reason he gave it up was because he actually had, he was hit a number of times. He finally broke his neck, actually. And... Wow, that's a reaction, Glenn.
that's not a great advertisement for bicycling.
Well, maybe it's an advertisement for maybe safer bicycling,
yeah.
Or something along
those lines.
Bike lanes,
perhaps.
Which, you know, we do talk a lot about here on WLRN. But in any case, you know, it had that impact that he just gave up a car in South Florida, which I think most people listening probably know is not an insignificant thing to do for all of those 10 years. And he still considers himself associated with the sloop. He would send oranges up north to Pete and his wife, Toshi, over the years. And
a la Mary Brickell to send the orange blossom right to Henry Flagler.
Exactly.
You keep at it. You know, what's really kind of telling about this tale here, Glenn and Margie, is, you know, Pete Seeger and what he was known for in the folk industry and you know, the impact that you know, this skipper can have not only on his own life but quite frankly is just kind of piloting this boat for this well-known folk singer, and the role that each of us may wind up playing years down the road in public policy. You never know. You always got to sign on for the cruise, right, Glenn? That's the lesson here, right, Glenn? Right, Margie? You got to get on the ship. You got to, you know, the journey begins with a push off.
And Seeger was amazing at getting people to raise their voices,
song
in protest.
Exactly. Yes. I'm so glad you said that, Margie, because nobody crossed his path without singing. For me, it was on the banks of the Hudson River. I'm from the Mid-Hudson Valley, so I'm from Pete Seeger's backyard. And maybe about 10 or so years ago, I found myself at some little event singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow with Pete Seeger. And I think everybody I know who has crossed his path has some similar story. And that sloop Clearwater eventually was named to the National Register of Historic Places 10 years ago.
Because of the role it played with the Clean Water Act.
Right, and I was there, I was covering that event when it was named to that register.
Well the
and
question
how about him singing Somos el Barco? We are the boat, we are the sea. I was once involved with bringing Pete Seeger to FSU for a concert.
Huh.
And yeah, drove him in my car. I thought it was pretty cool.
Oh, that's great.
But he loves to get the crowd singing, and Somos el Barco was the highlight of that concert for me, absolutely.
Margie Manziel with News Service of Florida, Glenn Garvin with the Miami Herald, and Alicia Zuckerman here with WLRN Miami Herald News. This is the Florida Roundup. If you missed any of the program, you can listen to it on these airwaves again tomorrow at 6 a.m. and on the website later today at WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Elaine Chin and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network is Steph Farrow. And I will correct that it was Julia Tuttle that sent the orange blossom to Henry Flagler, not Mary Brickell. So there we go. We've got our online chat as well at WLRN.org. Our executive producer at WLRN is Peter J. Mertz, and technical supervisor is Paul Leary. Of course, among the Pete Seeger tunes that everybody knows, Turn, 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 one of the oldest lyrics that was ever put to music. That'll do it for the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening.